I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Opioid addiction is a national public health crisis. The National Institute on Drug Abuse estimates more than 2 million Americans suffer from opioid use disorders, with 115 dying each day from opioid overdose. Ensuring those with opioid use disorder have access to effective and affordable treatment is imperative. Today, we look more closely at medicated-assisted treatment programs, which use a variety of medications to help keep those with opioid addiction disorder from using. In a few minutes, we talk with practitioners and providers of MAP programs. But first, do we have the capacity to provide medicated-assisted treatment to those who need it? Cindy Thomas is professor and associate dean for research at the Brandeis University Heller Graduate School, also a member of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative, and she joins us from her office on the phone. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Cindy, tell us more about your research into opioid use disorder treatment capacity and your findings.
Well, as background, we looked at the number of people who are treating patients with opioid use disorder with medications, and this is funded through the federal government. Since 2000, we've had access to specifically to Suboxone, buprenorphine, a medication that's taken orally, reduces craving for opioid and prevents withdrawal. It's an important component of treatment, and it was anecdotally, we know that it's underutilized. About only 2% of physicians are using, of physicians nationally have been using this to treat opioid addiction. Historically, there are several barriers that we know exist in getting physicians to use Suboxone and other medications to treat addiction. Since 2000, the federal government has required anybody using these buprenorphine, Suboxone, to get extra training in prescribing and so they and have a limit of the number of patients that they can treat. So we know now there are waiting lists for treatment, and surveys of treatment programs indicate that a small number of treatment programs are even allowing patients access to these medications that are really helpful in encouraging people to maintain treatment and avoid relapse. Our research at Brandeis specifically looked at those physicians who have been given authority to prescribe Suboxone, and we found that only a small fraction of the number of patients they have capacity to treat, they're actually treating. So not only do we have a few physicians and other prescribers who are approved to use to prescribe Suboxone and treat patients with medication-assisted treatment, of those who are approved to use this medication in treatment, they only are seeing a few patients.
Hmm. So as you're saying, the doctors have to be certified to prescribe these medications. What's the licensing or certification process?
Well, there's 8 hours of online training or in person at conferences, so it's not very burdensome. But the very fact of training is probably putting a chilling effect on physicians wanting to get into the practice. The reason that this is one of the only medication where physicians have to have extra training in order to be approved to prescribe, and the original rationale was that Suboxone, when first approved, was thought that it might be used for diversion. They wanted to avoid physicians prescribing without having access to any of the support services that are so necessary for drug-addicted patients.
Were you able to determine why so few doctors become eligible prescribers, and what are the barriers?
Well, so there have been speculated, I and other researchers have done a fair amount of looking into this. And so some of the reasons that we speculate are that there's, these are very seriously ill patients. They have often have complex medical conditions and associated behavioral health problems. And you really need to have access to support services when you're treating opioid-addicted patients. So if you don't have those services readily available for your patients, it's hard to get into treating patients for this disease. Yeah. Also, reimbursement for some of these continuous support services are quite low. You need to closely monitor patients in terms of urine testing and medical monitoring. And this is a chronic disease. Patients are, have to be treated for a long time, and there's a stigma associated with these patients. So there are many reasons that prescribers are not flocking to treat opioid addiction patients, opioid addicted patients.
And it's just medical doctors who can be certified to prescribe, right? This isn't, we're not talking about other healthcare providers, or are other healthcare providers eligible too?
In 2016, the federal government relaxed the requirements to allow, because they recognized that there was an access problem for patients, they relaxed the requirements to also include physician assistants and nurse practitioners to be allowed to get a waiver to treat patients with Suboxone.
So as you're looking into this, what changes would you recommend to increase our capacity of prescribers for the MAP program?
Well, I think it's like so many medical problems, I think it's got to be a multi-pronged approach. First of all, providing physicians and other prescribers access to those very necessary support services that are required to adequately treat opioid use disorder, increase the amount of education in medical schools around treating addicted patients and other substance use disorders. Public initiatives are really important in eliminating, reducing stigma around these patients. And in fact, I guess making it easier, the whole goal would be making it easier to get treatment than to get the drugs. One of the other efforts that folks are recommending is getting more primary care physicians into treating opioid-addicted patients. With it, there are a lot of issues around that. As I said, these patients need support. And one thing that states are doing are they're starting to invest money in new models of treatment, telemedicine, so that primary care practitioners, especially in rural areas, can get support from specialists and other models of care.
Cindy Thomas, Professor and Associate Dean for Research at the Brandeis University Heller Graduate School, also a member of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative. Thanks so much for taking time to talk with us this morning.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Also joining us in studio now is Dr. Lisa Taylor, an internist and certified prescriber for opioid addiction treatment medication. She's also she's with Beth Israel, deaconess in Sandwich, and also with Clean Slate. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Yvonne Nickerson, licensed social worker and the addiction program manager at Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Good morning, Yvonne.
Good morning.
All right, so Clean Slate, tell us what that is.
Well, Clean Slate is actually a, it started out as a very small organization in Northampton, Massachusetts, that specifically just treated opiate addiction. And I can't remember when it got started. It was several years ago. But since then, it has been bought out by a large corporation. Excuse me. So it's for profit, and it has expanded to many states in the country. So it's just specifically for addiction, opiate addiction, but we also treat alcohol addiction as well.
Right. So, and you are a primary care doctor who moved into addiction treatment.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you started the addiction treatment program at the Community
That's
Health
right,
Center
many years ago. Yeah. Yes.
So, give us some background on when and why you began to focus on addiction treatment.
Well, actually, we saw the need, just like community health. I mean, the real purpose of community health is to identify the needs of the community and then supply the services that are needed. So we noted, I think it was probably back in 2006 or so, that we needed to have a program that would accommodate some of these patients that were addicted to opiates, you know, heroin and prescription pills. So I went to New York City, to Harlem, actually, and got waivered there, which was a really interesting experience. And came back. It took us a while to get the program together, but we ended up working with Duffy Health Center on what's called the OBOT grant, which is the outpatient-based opiate treatment, and we worked together to start treating patients. We started out with like a handful of patients. I think we probably had 10 to begin with, and we were completely overwhelmed. Yeah. It was a lot of work.
Yeah. Yvonne, describe the MAP program at the Community Health Center and how it's evolved since it first started.
So thank you, Lisa, for piloting the program, because it has grown. When I first was there a couple of years ago, we were around 80. We have grown to almost 200 at this time. We do treat with Vivitrol now and Suboxone and Subutex as well. And we also have a very structured program. So we work with patients at least once a week, all the way through to once a month, depending on where they are, what level of activity, use, relapse rate, social determinants, such as what are they having problem with housing, resources, financial, family, and then, of course, their mental health needs. So we try to encompass all those things, wrap our arms around our patients as they walk through the door, assess them, get them the help we need. And we're in a unique position as the community health center because we do offer it's integrated care.
Yeah. I would say there was a lot of head nodding when we were talking to Cindy Thomas, right, and what she was saying.
Right.
And so what are some of the reasons that we don't see more doctors treating addiction? I mean, you know, you two kind of went that route, but
right. Right.
Why are we not seeing more?
Well, it's a complicated problem, and I think it's not just giving somebody medication and then sending them on their way. When it comes to opiate addiction or even alcoholism, it's really a society issue. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this huge stigma. It's time consuming. These patients are incredibly high risk. I mean, the rate of relapse is sometimes up towards, you know, 30-40% with patients who are in recovery or attempting to be in recovery. So you really need more than just a prescriber to write a script. I mean, there are programs that still exist. There used to be quite a few of them. We used to call them cash businesses, where the patient would go in and they would take no insurance and they'd have to pay $200, $500, whatever the case may be, just to be seen. And then sometimes insurance would pay for their medication, but to see the prescriber, they would have to pay cash. And all they got was the medication. There were no services involved. In order for this medication to work, it's a tool. I mean, it's just a Band-Aid. All it's going to do is to prevent, or hopefully prevent, the patient from going into withdrawal. If you can prevent withdrawal, the patient can feel, quote, normal, or a little bit more normal, and then they can focus on their recovery. But in order to do that, you need social workers, you need psychiatry. There's a lot of, most patients have what we call dual diagnosis. Very few people, I find, they have some sort of mental disorder, depression, anxiety, bipolar, whatever. So you need mental health specialists and sometimes even psychiatry. And then you need case management. So we used to call it like the three-legged stool. There was the prescriber, like the MD, there was mental health, and then there was this case management, which was the nurse that runs the program. So you need to encompass a tremendous amount of resources, and that's not cheap, and it's incredibly time consuming. So for primary care doctors who, you know, if anybody knows what primary care is like these days, it's overwhelming. Right. And, you know, you're working sort of at capacity, and then to sort of fold this into your practice is a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And you mentioned a 30-40% relapse rate. And I think that's important to talk about because, you know, people who are in recovery or thinking about it, and then, you know, they relapse and then they think, oh, I can't do it. And that's common. Relapse is common.
Right.
So for somebody who relapsed, they shouldn't give up hope at
that
point.
Right. So there, you know, there's sort of two programs that were there. We started initially as a sobriety only program back in the health center. It was like, you better not do anything or else you're out of here. But then we sort of got into the more popular and more effective harm reduction program where, you know, people are human and they make mistakes and you have to be there to support them. Because if you're not and you just sort of let them go, the chances of them dying is incredibly high.
So just to add to that, we have really gone to the other way where we have harm reduction. And there is a high incidence of not only relapse on the opiates or the alcohol that they're being treated for, but also use of other illicit drugs.
Right.
So that brings in they're feeling great. They're not having any withdrawal. So now they're exposing themselves to cocaine or marijuana, of course, is used frequently. Adderall is a huge one. Benzos.
Right.
Another. So what we try to do and promote is the relationship between me as a social worker, the nurse, the doctor, so that when things are not going great or they're relapsing or they're surrounding themselves with active users, that they'll come in and talk to us about it, that they won't be afraid, that they're not, you know, a lot of the time they're afraid they're going to be kicked out of the program.
Right.
So to be honest and have that discussion so you can work with that. What do you need?
Right. I think it's important to understand that these are patients who have really withdrawn from society. Mm-hmm. They are not part of the community. And whereas they were initially, I mean, this didn't happen overnight, but they have severed ties with their family and their friends. They've lost their job. They've lost their children. They've lost their car. It's just, there's so many different levels of dysfunction. And in order to get that person back into the community takes a tremendous amount of effort, mostly by the patient, obviously. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. tremendous amount of work, but also by the support staff. And there are times where things can be going along very well, and you think that that patient is in the clear, and next mm-hmm. thing you know, you know, they've overdosed.
Right. And I think the other key thing here is being in an environment that's non-judgmental. Because
right.
as society, that whole stigma thing, mm-hmm. and probably they've been judged as all of these things are
right.
happening in their lives, and they get to be, as you're saying, Yvonne, with this relationship that's very non-judgmental. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking with Dr. Lisa Taylor, internist and certified prescriber for opioid addiction treatment medication, and Yvonne Nickerson, licensed social worker and the addictions program manager at Community Health Center of Cape Cod. We're talking about medicated-assisted treatment programs, which use a variety of medications to help keep those with opioid addiction disorder from using. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking kind of like this team and this support. Yvonne, who's involved in that at the Community Health Center? What are their roles, and what is the role of the primary care doctor?
So the role of the primary care doctor, a patient comes in, they get assigned one. That primary care can also be their prescriber. Often that's not the case, just because the doctor that's the prescriber has a limited amount of patients, as we know, that they can have. So they also are part of the team. Then they're taking care of their medical needs. If they have any high risk complications like diabetes, hep C, HIV, they are in control of making those referrals and making sure that the patient is getting what they need and those needs are met. Then you have the prescriber, who's also part of the team, who of course is prescribing the medication. They also have to see the patient depending on where they are on their treatment plan. It's either once a week or once a month. And then you have the nurse that is also, they see the patient most often. They see the patient when they're first coming in. They're assigning the patient to the other doctors. They're doing the induction, and they're monitoring their progress and doing their lab work once a week. And then you have behavioral health. For the most part, most of our patients are put what we call an early recovery group, which meets once a week. We used to make it mandatory. We now make it highly recommend it. We realize people, especially as they progress in their treatment, that they don't really need to come every week. Once a month is good, or they can move on to individual therapy. So that's a team of about four people. But then you also, the people that they meet on the front line, who's checking them mm-hmm. in, who's checking them out, who they see on a regular basis, maybe outside of our clinic. Those are also all part of the team. So we usually have releases and that type of thing.
So with this MAP program, it's open to anyone, even mm-hmm. if they aren't a patient at the health center. So do they get that same model of integrated care?
At this time, yes, we have opened up the addictions program to people outside of our scope of patients. They do get the same level of care. Their primary care, though, would be, of course, somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But we do work closely with that person. They have to sign a release so that we have access to their medical records and that sort of thing. And if anybody else is involved, we would like to have a release for that as well.
All right, Lisa, is that the sort of what happens at Clean Slate, something similar to that?
Yeah, Clean Slate, it does not have this close integration of primary care that the community health center does. There is a group of primary care docs literally like on the other side of the wall that some of our patients are involved in, especially early on in the program when Clean Slate started. But Clean Slate is specifically for addiction. So some of our patients don't have primary care docs. The ones that don't have primary care docs, we try really hard to get them primary care physicians because most of these patients have other medical needs. But it's the same thing. They see either a nurse practitioner or a PA who sees them on a regular basis. There's the prescriber, and then there's groups. There's individual groups. There are groups that are run by social workers. And then I meet patients on a quarterly basis that just to, you know, check in on them. We do discussions about how medication works, the struggles that they've had. With this this quarter, we actually have a program and a lecture on Narcan and how we use Narcan, which is a reversal agent for people who are overdosing. Everybody should be trained in. So there's a lot of education, but it's really a sort of a standalone place for just addiction.
Mm-hmm. So do you find when some of your patients are in recovery and they're doing really well, but they're still taking the drug, they say, well, I replace one drug for another.
Mm-hmm.
What how does that work? It's not really what they've done, but they might feel that, all right, I'm not taking, you know, oxycodone or anything anymore, but now I'm taking...
Oh, the Suboxone.
Cells, yeah.
Right. Yeah. There is a lot of stigma around that. And some of the patients feel that way. It's important, I think, when it comes to stigma, just in general, it really is a lack of understanding of how things work for the most part. So when it comes to Suboxone, it really doesn't work in the way that an opiate does. Opiates get you high. The way that they function is that, you know, they bind a receptor in your cell and it turns a cell on. And it releases these, you know, tremendous amounts of feel-good neurotransmitters. But Suboxone, it just... you know, binds that receptor and just satisfies the receptor so the person doesn't go into withdrawal, but it doesn't get them high.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is, the point of it is to make people comfortable, physically comfortable, because they're, you know, the withdrawal, that's the dependency. That's dependency. It's the withdrawal. And it can be very uncomfortable and people get quite sick. Suboxone takes care of the withdrawal. The addiction is really the behavior that goes along with the drug use. And that addiction needs to be dealt with. That's where the work comes in. Mm-hmm. Taking a Suboxone every day is not difficult, but working on your addiction is really complicated.
And you talk about education and that being key. And so I'm going to go back farther, like for kids. I mean, I've been surprised at some of the young people that we've had on the program. And I've said this before, because it's so surprising to me that they go, I had no idea this road I was going down.
Right.
That they had, I mean, nobody wants to wake up addicted to drugs.
Right.
That isn't how they started.
Right.
But it is surprising how little some of these young people know about what these drugs do.
Right, exactly. I think a lot of times people just start recreationally when it comes to any kind of drug use. You know, maybe they start by just drinking and smoking pot. Maybe they're at a party someday and somebody gives them a Percocet and they feel good. And they maybe a couple weeks later they take another one. And next thing you know, they feel even better and they just want that feeling back. And the only way to get it is to take that drug.
Yeah. We've had Dr. Ruth Pody on a few times, and I'm sure you know she's amazing.
Right.
And this statistic, I think, bears repeating again and again. If you can get a child to the, you know, when the frontal lobe is developed,
right,
like 24, 25,
right,
with never having had any alcohol or drugs,
right,
less than 1%
right,
chance of becoming an addict. Less than 1%. That is amazing.
It is amazing.
And the younger you start, the higher that percentage.
Well, it changes your brain. I mean, that's the thing about drug use, or, you know, or even when it comes to alcohol use, it changes your brain. You know, that chronic use, especially for opiates, it depletes your brain of those feel-good neurotransmitters. So now the only way you're going to get any kind of, you know, euphoria in your life is by using drugs.
Mm. All right, let's talk to Christine, who's giving us a call from Oak Bluffs. Hi, Christine.
Good morning. Thank you for doing the show.
Sure.
I live on Martha's Vineyard, and we are just starting a medically assisted program through our community services here that actually takes insurance. We've had physicians here who have been prescribing but don't take any insurance, and it's basically a cash-only business. So I'm excited that we have this opportunity to now dispense Suboxone, but I have a question about methadone and Suboxone and how they're related to each other. We have a population out here that is on methadone, and we have no dispensary on the island for it. So it means they have to take a boat off every morning and go to Wareham.
Mm-hmm.
And if the boats aren't running, they're not getting their methadone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my question is, can you describe the difference? I think I know what it is, but maybe for our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to talk about how one would transition from methadone to Suboxone and maybe increase the odds that they're getting better and consistent treatment.
All right. Thanks
for
that question.
I'll take that one
okay.
on. So And it's not a simple answer, unfortunately. So when I was doing my training, you know, several years ago, this is the way it was described to me. If you can imagine that your body is a car and the key is the drug, whether it's heroin or Percocet or Suboxone or methadone, let's say the key is the opiate. You put the key in the car, you turn the car on, the car goes 100 miles an hour. That's an opiate. With methadone, because it's a different type, it's an opiate, but it's a different type of opiate, put the methadone in the car, you turn the car on, the car goes 30 miles an hour. So you're not getting the rush, but there's a little bit of activity with that cell, with that receptor. With Suboxone, put the Suboxone in the car, you turn the car idles, doesn't go anywhere. So the receptors are satisfied. There's no rush of these feel-good neurotransmitters. Methadone, there is a little bit. So there's a, you know, people do get a little bit of a buzz from it. Of course, there's a lot of tolerance as the treatment goes on. But it's, you know, the thing with methadone, you know, it's an old drug. It's been around for a long time. It is a difficult drug to get off of. And in order to transition from methadone to Suboxone, you have to be off for a few days, actually. Mm-hmm. So people have to taper down and then they can get back on the Suboxone. And, you know, some people are willing to do that. Other people are like, well, if I'm going to go through all the trouble of getting off methadone, if I can do it without anything, I'm just going to do without. Mm-hmm. And of course, if they have cravings and then they use, of course, they usually go back to the same dose they were using at an overdose. Yeah. So there's, you know, that risk as well. So it can be done. It's not done easily, but it can be done. Mm-hmm. The thing about Suboxone that's helpful, and this is why it was really developed and brought into this country and used, is because you can take it home and use it. We can give people a week supply, 2 week supply, a month supply, whereas methadone, it's daily dosing.
Yeah. And boy, I have to get on the boat and come to
Wayne.
That's like, yeah. But talk about a barrier.
Right.
That's a, Christine, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've talked a couple of times. We heard this. You have a number of patients you can have. How is that number determined?
Well, the federal government actually determined initially, first, it started in the first year of your waiver, one can prescribe for 30. This is sort of like the old rules. You can prescribe for 30. After a year, you can apply for an increase, and that increase was 100. And then back about a year ago or so, the CARA, there was something called the CARA law, and then you can increase the number to 275, but you have to apply to that for that as well. So now the max is 275. I don't know who thought of that number,
right. But
yeah, I know. It's pretty random. Yeah, it's a pretty random number. I know that I am not at capacity where I am. I don't even think I'm close to it.
Yeah. So are you able to meet the demand for that program with at Clean Slate?
You know, I think it's really a matter of slots available. I mean, there are prescribers there. We have capacity, but, you know, the prescribers have capacity, but there's only so many physician's assistants and so many hours in the day to
for that
really,
support stuff.
Right, exactly.
About. Yeah. What about the community health center?
So we have one doctor who is at the 275. We have another that's up to 100 this year, and then another one that will be applying for the 100. So we have the capacity, of course, to take in many more patients. But again, we only have the support staff is limited. And also the doctors and the nurse practitioners also have a full panel of patients
right.
in addition to that. So
I'm just thinking, too, we're talking about these being high-risk patients, often with dual diagnosis and a lot of difficulty. That in itself, I'm just thinking of the whole support team, you know, the doctors, the nurses, everybody. And you're not making $1 million doing this. So this is, I would imagine, a high kind of burnout sort of job, right? I mean, how do you keep your staff, you know, energized, if you will, and you know, not wanting to go home and cry in the corner?
I think people get into this field because they're passionate about it. I know most of the staff that I work with, we kind of ended up after school doing an internship, or our first job was in the field, and it's totally different work than, say, mental health individual therapy. It's more interaction with the patient. You really build that relationship. So I think once you kind of caught that bug and become passionate about it, you do everything that you can.
Right.
Yeah. You may move around to different positions, but it's still, interacting with the patient.
Yeah, and it's also when somebody succeeds, when you mm-hmm. see somebody succeed, I mean, they have lost everything. They have they have spent time in jail. They have their family doesn't speak to them. Their children don't speak to them. They have no job. They lived on the street. They have lost everything. And now they've come back and they've just spent Christmas with their family and things went really well. And they've been clean for 4 years and they just bought their first car. I mean, I'm like getting goosebumps just thinking about it. I mean, it's so gratifying. And it's hard to see that in primary care, I'll tell you. I mean, I see a lot of patients in my practice and I have the same conversations with people, exercise and diet. But, it doesn't really happen all that often. But when you see somebody who's really working hard in recovery, it's like the most amazing feeling.
I can imagine, So availability of treatment beds is often discussed when we're talking about addiction treatment. What determines if a patient is a candidate for outpatient versus inpatient treatment?
You want to take that one?
So if they're coming in for a first induction and they're really having trouble maintaining the starting dose, if they're still having severe withdrawals, we always recommend a higher level of care. So that would be a detox, of course. Same thing with alcohol. Usually if they're alcohol is much more dangerous of a withdrawal process. So we almost always say you really need to go to detox before you start treatment. So we work with the patient to get the bed. We, call the area facilities and try to do that. And in the process, help maintain their health and their well-being until that can happen. It's sometimes a difficult process, but if we work in the field, we usually have a tie. We have contracts with certain, like High Point and Gosnell, where we have more readily accessible care. It still takes
you can
some
usually
time.
Get a bed when you need one?
Not immediately, but it's a process, but it's usually not, it's working with the staff at those facilities and getting them in.
And patients who have failed have multiple overdoses, especially if they've been Narcan'd and they've been very close to dying. Those patients are considered extremely high risk. Mm-hmm. And then, honestly, to be perfectly honest, it's money. If you've got the money, you can go to a private facility anytime you want.
Yeah, most of these people don't have the money, though.
Right. No. Yeah. Well, a lot of people do, actually. Yeah. It really doesn't discriminate. I have plenty of people who college degrees, they've got excellent jobs, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the people you're saying who don't have a job.
Yes.
Those people don't have the money.
Well, they don't, right. Yeah. They used to, but they don't anymore.
But
right.
As we always say, that's the progression of the disease.
Right. Yeah.
So it's good to have the early recovery groups because you do have a mix of people who are educated, have full-time jobs, who are high-functioning still, all the way down to people who just have lost everything.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a good thing for them to... 866-999-4626
is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about medicated assisted treatment programs with Dr. Lisa Taylor, internist and certified prescriber for opioid addiction treatment medication, with Beth Israel, deaconess and sandwich. She's also with Clean Slate, and Yvonne Nickerson, licensed social worker and the addiction program manager at Community Health Center of Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how do you determine if someone is a candidate for these MAP programs and might not be a good candidate?
Well, initially they have to want treatment. That's the biggest thing. They have to want to walk in the door and accept some help. Some patients are, as I said, they've had multiple relapses. They've realized that they cannot function without either using or something to help them with their withdrawals. That's probably one of the biggest things. People who have come very close to dying, multiple overdoses. I would say that's probably, as far as I'm concerned, that's pretty much it.
So who's not a candidate? Maybe somebody who's maybe doing well?
Yeah, or recreational use, or people who are using, but they don't really have the addiction necessarily. Mm-hmm. They may have some dependency. They don't feel good if they're not using, but they don't really have that the cravings, mm-hmm. these deep cravings. They may not be using every day. Maybe they're using very small amounts and they're able to go several days without using. You really don't want to get somebody started on a medication that they're going to be using long term if they don't need it.
If they don't need it, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of different medications that are used in this treatment. We've been talking about Suboxone, mm-hmm. but there's Vivitrol, mm-hmm. methadone. We mentioned methadone. Mm-hmm. So you talked about the difference between Suboxone and methadone. What about Vivitrol?
So Vivitrol is a different type of medication altogether. It can be used orally on a daily basis, but more popular is this injection that lasts about a month. And where Suboxone binds the receptor and satisfies the receptor, Vivitrol does the same thing, but it blocks it in a sense where nothing else can sort of attach onto it. You can't bump it off like you can for Suboxone. So it's very sticky. It's actually a very similar substance is used in Narcan. But it can be used for people for alcohol, which is great, and opiates. So if people are using both, it's very handy in that regard. And also people don't have to show up. People who are doing really well in the recovery, but they may have moments where they're having intense cravings. They can come in, get their injection, and you don't have to see them for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever use these drugs in combination? Or
no.
No, never.
You
okay,
can't.
You're both going,
yeah.
No, absolutely yeah, not. Also, I'm thinking that, we did a program a while back about a program using acupuncture, which was, I guess, it reducing the cravings, but not indirectly, because it was
right.
like reducing the anxiety
right.
that was contributing to
right.
the craving. So do you recommend some of those alternatives like that?
Sure.
I mean, yeah.
If you can
yeah.
afford it, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Insurance doesn't cover acupuncture at this point in our lives. I wish it did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you're mentioning there's sometimes, dual diagnosis, whether it's physical or sometimes it could be other mental health problems. How do you determine? I mean, I would think that might be tough to determine in the beginning of this process when they're coming in. No, not so much.
We do behavioral health assessments because we highly recommend that they also do our early recovery group. So they have to do a behavioral assessment. So those things are determined through that. A lot of adverse child experiences, domestic violence, sexual assaults are all, usually discovered during that time. Mm-hmm. And the social determinants, what's going on in your life right now, family relationships, primary intimate relationships, what their needs are, what are they looking for in treatment, what do they really want to focus on. We kind of go through all that. We don't push it.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma is, we like to say, in addiction, either you have trauma through your use or you had trauma and that's why you were using.
Yeah.
So we don't push that. We realize it's a big part of it.
And it's amazing. Trauma really, you may not realize, because some childhood trauma can really have an impact, not only on your mental health, but your physical health.
Absolutely.
And I think we're just really kind of starting to learn.
Well, the two are intimately, yeah.
There's a huge study that was done, 20, the doctor talks about that.
Dr. Ruth Pody, yeah.
Yeah. That if you've had four or more adverse child experiences, it drops your life expectancy by 10 years, yeah. Six or more by 20.
Right.
So add addiction to that.
Right. And it's, that's a nice thing about, really integrating behavioral health and primary care and addiction is that, if you're not doing well mentally, you're not doing well physically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Ginger Norleans asked, does cannabis, when used by younger people, also form brain chemistry changes that can lead to the kinds of habits you described for opiates?
Mm-hmm.
Both are nodding your
heads.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a tricky subject when it comes to marijuana use, because it's legal in the state. And as is alcohol, but it's a substance as well. And when you're dealing with patients who are trying to, are struggling with recovery, and yet they're using a substance, it's, you really have to wonder, how clear their head is as far as moving forward. It's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Are adolescents good candidates for the MAT programs? Is there an age minimum to any of this?
Our age minimum, I think, is 18. I mean, we treat adults, basically.
Mm-hmm. Ours as well. You have to have a specific certification in order to treat adolescents.
Right. I have seen, though, several studies where there have been children as young as 12.
Wow.
Right. It's not very common. 16 mm-hmm. years old is probably more common. But the same thing, if you have a person who is struggling and their cravings are so severe that they're going to use no matter what, you're going to give them something to help.
If you have a question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We talked a little bit about relapse when you're in recovery. And are there typical events or circumstances that trigger relapse? I mean, this can really happen at any time, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, relapse is always part of the process, and we try to explain that to patients because they're usually very upset and fearful, and there's shame involved in that and guilt. But we always, you know, talk about any life changes, people having babies, getting married. I had a patient who just lost her job. You know, domestic violence events, any kind of trauma, surgeries are a huge part of that, and that has to be planned for. So these are all things that you need to talk about, need to plan for, and put some things in place that will help you get through that process. And of course, therapy is a big part of that.
And sometimes it's just who you're living with. I mean, we've had patients who are, you know, they're living in an apartment, they've been there forever and they can't afford to move, and the roommates are using, and they're trying really hard to maintain their sobriety and they can't. Or it's peer pressure. They go to a party. Holidays are huge. Holidays are a big problem. Families are always triggers for a lot of our patients.
Workplace is a
workplace.
Big issue.
Yes,
too.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm.
Is there a typical length of time that people stay in the MAT program?
Well, it used to be when I first started, they used to say a year, and after a year, let's start tapering down. But it has been shown that people can be on it for several years, and they may not feel ready to taper down. You really have to feel your patient out to see if they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your experience?
I agree.
So,
yes.
Could there somebody be on this indefinitely?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there side effects to the Suboxone that you need to worry about? Or
there's no long-term studies.
Right.
But in my experience, I have not seen any adverse reactions. I know a lot of patients will start after a year or two. They'll come lower their dose and may maintain a dose at around 2 to 4 milligrams, and they're okay with that. Vivitrol, the manufacturer states that there's a 12-month to 13-month limit on the use of that. So we have had patients go over that, but not by much.
Right.
And I know a lot of times in the jails they use Vivitrol.
Right.
And so when you have patients who, as you mentioned, coming out of jail, do you switch them from Vivitrol to Suboxone?
It depends on how they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they have done well on Vivitrol, then we keep them on Vivitrol. It's nice because it self-tapers. Mm-hmm. And you can have somebody who just doesn't show up anymore, and they're like, okay, they're doing great. And, you know, just call us if you need us.
Right. All right. Bill is giving us a call from Marston's Mills. Good morning, Bill.
Oh, good morning to you. How are you?
Great.
Good. I'm calling actually from Marston's Mills, Cape Cod Church of Christ, where we run the Celebrate Recovery program. And I would like to just let people know that we do have this program for people in recovery. I'm well aware that many people are living in isolation, carry shame, past abuse, and whatever else it is that drives them to the pain and the relief that they seek through drugs or alcohol. We're there to help. It costs nothing, and we are available every Wednesday evening between 6:15 and 8:30.
Yeah, Bill, thanks for calling and sharing that, and we appreciate you letting our listeners know about that. It's a good place to start, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Right, yeah. Absolutely. There's a lot of programs in the community. I know in Plymouth they have, every other week at police stations, you can just walk in there and ask for help. There's, a lot of times you just have to get on the web and start searching.
And families, people who are going, there's also like the Al-Anon, to understand what's happening. So it isn't always just the person in recovery who may need these support
Absolutely,
groups.
Right.
It affects everyone, in the family and in the community. I know addiction is a disease that affects your mind, body, and your spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So finding that spirituality that works for you is hugely important.
Absolutely.
So we're talking about the addiction that needs to be treated as well as any other chronic disease and everything that's going on. So how much of the addiction treatment, particularly the MAP programs, are covered by insurance? Does insurance pay for this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It depends on we've had some patients who, for some reason, the insurance company will pay for everything, but will only pay for a portion of the Vivitrol.
Right.
So they
Vivitrol
could have
is tough.
Yeah, they could have a copay from $500 to some won't pay anything, and it's $1,900 for the injection. But we have the oral medication that they can use that is covered.
Right.
We've never had a problem with Suboxone. Mm-hmm. We usually just have to get a prior auth.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do to increase the number of prescribers? We talked about a little bit some of the barriers that are there. Obviously, the need is certainly great, and at this point, doesn't seem like the numbers are going down anytime soon.
Doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, so what do we do? How do we get more prescribers?
It's education. Actually, I love the idea of really educating medical students. I know when I was in med school, I graduated in 1993, there was absolutely... We didn't even talk about alcoholism all that much. In psychiatry, we did a little bit, but with nothing for opiate addiction because, opiate addicts were, poor, inner city, homeless. They weren't your next door neighbors.
Mm-hmm. They are now.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yes. It's education. You have to start by educating physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs. And I think we have to start by educating the public. There's a tremendous amount of stigma. And the stigma is... just based in lack of understanding.
Mm-hmm. We had a mom on talking about her son's struggle, who he is in recovery and doing well. But one of the things in her book, she talked about it from her the parents' perspective. And she said, you have to change your expectations. Her expectations to what her son was going to grow up and become come now to just him living day to day and being healthy from one day to the next. And same thing, struggled with that stigma. And once she kind of put that behind her, that I think helped her in her sort of recovery.
Right.
With
you have to really, understand that addiction is a disease. It's a disease like diabetes and hypertension. It's just a disease in your head. That's the organ that's being affected. So the manifestation of that disease is behavior and not necessarily, high blood sugar or high blood pressure. But it's a disease just like any other.
Yeah. So, we're thinking training needs to be here, but what are some of the other biggest challenges or opportunities that you see ahead of us?
Money,
money,
you need funding. You need funding. You really do. You need funding, and you need to have support from the government, because without it, it's just, as I said, there's a lot of overhead in these programs. The patients are incredibly complex. It's very hard for just a solo practitioner or a primary care doctor. If you're out in the, in a rural community, you may not have a choice, but it's very difficult to run a primary care practice and incorporate a MAP program at the same time. It's very difficult.
And in our circumstances at the Community Health Center, we do have resources available to us. We are Bureau of Substance Abuse Services certified, so we have access to grant money there. We have access to grant money on a federal level. So we do have that ability to gather some resources. It does not, of course, cover all of the costs of the overhead, but we are in a little bit better position than somebody who's trying to do this on a primary care level in their own office.
Right. And just finally, Lisa, you mentioned you have to want to
right.
be, you have to
right.
want that.
That's the biggest thing.
And
mm-hmm.
so if you're a family member and you have somebody struggling, there's nothing you can do, really, until that person wants help, right?
Well, I always say any opportunity that you can get someone into treatment mm-hmm. is an opportunity to plant a seed. Mm. So even if they've gone 10 times and they're still not sober, they have learned something every time they've gone.
Absolutely.
So their readiness level hopefully will increase.
Right.
So parents do have that opportunity. There's other ways of getting people into treatment. And it's always, an opportunity to try.
Okay. We'll have links with more information about the Community Health Center of Cape Cod's addiction treatment programs and Clean Slate programs at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Lisa Taylor and Yvonne Nickerson, thanks so much for joining
us.
And thanks for
the
work that you
do.
Thank
thanks. You.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.